I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. A family of serial killers who were never caught, a fortune left buried along the banks of a creek by the Dalton Gang, and orphans shipped from New York for a good life on the prairie. These are some of the mysteries and myths of Kansas. This hour, we'll pull back the curtain on some of the Sunflower State's most fascinating stories. Plus, when lawmakers in Kansas couldn't make a decision on redistricting, a panel of federal judges did it for them. We'll look at the fallout as both parties scramble to field candidates in every district. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I'd never heard of the Bloody Benders until I read the new book, Myths and Mysteries of Kansas. Turns out we may have had the nation's first full-fledged serial killers right here. The book also covers the Dalton Gang, the possibility that Amelia Earhart had a long-lost daughter, and those lonesome orphan trains racing across the prairie. Later on this hour, all the controversy in Topeka these days over redistricting and where things stand today, just one day after Monday's filing deadline. We'll get an update. But first up, all those myths and mysteries of Kansas. With us today, Diana Lambden Meyer. She's an award-winning travel journalist and a member of the Society of American Travel Writers. She's the current author of the popular Day Trips from Kansas City travel guide, just out in a new edition. And Diana, so good to have you back here again.
It's nice to be back here again.
Well, you weren't born in Kansas or even raised here. How tough was it for you to find all these good stories?
Well, that was a bit of a challenge when my editor first called me. And people ask me a lot, how did you get the idea of the book? Well, it wasn't my idea at all. The publisher, the Globe Pequot Press, has this series. And Kansas is number 24. And the very first thing I said, well, gee, we've got a lot of crazy people in Kansas. Yes. Why are you waiting so long? But no, it was not that difficult because I've lived in the Kansas City area for more than 25 years, and we've traveled all over Kansas and written about it extensively. And I love history, and I love the odd, quirky things. And you may be referencing the very last chapter in the book. I have family roots in Kansas in the 1880s.
That's one of your stories in the book.
Right. And when my editor in New York called me to talk about this, she said, you have to do a chapter on Amelia Earhart. And I said, okay, but I have to do a chapter on my Aunt Amanda. And I told her the story, and she's like, okay, so we've got two chapters down. Give me 11 more.
And you're so, all set.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn to the Bloody Benders, because as I mentioned, I'd never heard of this story. The Benders is the name of a family, the last name. Scary folks.
And history calls them a family, but there's no certainty that they were even all related. It was in the 1870s, what they assumed was a father and son came and staked a claim down in Labette, Kansas, and started working it. And
down near Coffeyville,
Down by a little bit north of Coffeyville near Cherryvale. Mm-hmm. And it's in Labette County. And so they worked it, and the next spring then what they assumed was a mother and daughter came, and all of a sudden people started disappearing on the prairie.
And one after another.
And really the business that the family set up was kind of a little trading post in kind of place. And so people would come along the Osage Trail and stop there for groceries or a meal or whatever. And there were body parts found out on the prairie, and there were stories of missing people all over from the East Coast. People were looking for their missing relatives there.
You know, one thing that struck me about this story was, I guess it was just a sign of the times coming as it did right after the Civil War, but people would go missing and they'd be missing for a while.
Right.
I mean, these days, if you're missing for 12 hours, people are in a panic.
Right.
But in those days, well, you know, shouldn't have old Joe, you know, he should have showed up there by now. Where
right.
is he?
Right,
you know,
right. We haven't heard from him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was interesting that because, you know, life on the prairie was very rough and,
yeah.
and full of risk. So the fact that, you know, your mother or aunt in on the East Coast is trying to track you down is kind of interesting. But basically,
these folks would show up in the store, uh-huh. and have a meal. They always would have their backs to the kitchen.
That was a key part of it. It was this, you know, little cabin, little store kind of thing. And they always had the guest, and it was usually a male guest, sit with his back to what they described this greasy, grimy curtain. And then Pa Bender and the son, John Bender, well, then Kate, the voluptuous daughter, Kate. That's how she was always described, is voluptuous. And she would cook and talk, and she would distract these people. And John Bender and Pa Bender would come behind the curtain, club them in the head. Then their body would drop into a pit below the house.
There's a trap door actually
in the floor of the
dining room.
Right,
there.
Right. And it would drop into this pit, where the bodies were mutilated, slit, you know, their throat ear to ear, dismembered, all sorts of things. And this went on for the better part of 3 or 4 years. And
again, showing you how much slower things moved in those days than they would today.
Right, right. And it was not until a colonel from the Civil War was trying to track down his brother that, you know, the heat really started being very intense on the Benders. And so the family disappeared.
And they disappeared just very quickly.
Right,
here
right.
Here today, gone tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, and again, you know, your neighbors aren't right there beside you, and you don't know what everybody's doing every minute. They weren't posting on Facebook, gee, we're taking a road trip.
Off to Topeka today.
Yeah. But a couple of days later, one of the neighbors was walking by and realized that the farm animals were in bad shape. They had not been fed. They were starving, you know, and all of this. And so he started looking around, and that's when the investigation unfurled. And
And tell us how it did unfurl and what they began to find, you know.
Well, and again, there weren't even really any sheriffs or elected officials at that time to take care of this kind of thing. So a town councilman member kind of led the search. And when they got into the house, and there was this, you know, the stench of blood and the staleness and the stench of blood. And they first found the trap door and realized what was going on. And then they started walking in the back, what was supposed to have been an orchard, which really only had about one apple tree in it. And they found newspaper reports and accounts from that time vary between 8 and 11 graves. And one grave was a father who had been dismembered, and his 3-year-old daughter was thrown in the grave and buried alive on top of him.
Yeah, just really astonishing
yeah.
stuff.
What
impact did the news of this have on Kansas and have on the Midwest? I mean, this must have been just absolutely shocking in the wake of the Civil War here.
Well, and the folks in Topeka were not excited about this at all, because it's, you know, we're wanting people to come to Kansas and settle, and, you know, this was not good. So there was a great deal of money then put into an investigation and tracking down the Bender family, and they must have split and gone different directions, and no one is ever sure what happened to them. There were two women about 15 years later arrested at a logging camp in Michigan, and they went by different names, but by all accounts, those were the Bender women, Ma and Kate, and they brought them back to Oswego for trial, and I kind of think how Judge Judy or somebody would have handled that trial, because it just, by all accounts, I mean, they were screaming and yelling and calling each other bad names, and the mom and the daughter get into a fight, literally a physical fight rolling in the courtroom floor during their trial. And
this is comely Kate who's involved with
yes,
this, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, voluptuous Kate.
Voluptuous
She's
Kate.
She's voluptuous, yes. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, they it was a hung jury. And so Ma and Kate, actually, they put them on a train and said, get out of Kansas. Don't come back.
What's your sense? I mean, were those the two women who were involved in the murders, or are you questioning that yourself?
You know, I would say they probably were, just because the constable who was doing all the tracking down really had worked very hard. And he took his lumps in the press that he was wasting a lot of money. He tracked down every lead. And he had 100% confidence that they were who they were. But it was just kind of a messed up jury system and trial at the time that let them go. And that was just the mom and the daughter. The dad and the son, no one knows for sure. There were some indication that maybe they went toward Texas, Arizona, that story. But then there's a whole nother train of thought and a belief system that the entire family was caught someplace down in Oklahoma or Texas. They were all killed and buried right there. And the posse that went after them, you know, all pledged to secrecy. And so there's no knowing.
We just don't really know.
We don't know who they were before they came. And they might have done an equal number of disgusting deeds before they came to Kansas. And they might have gone on to do it elsewhere.
I assume there's a lot written about the Bloody Benders.
You know, not as much as you would have thought. I went to, you know, Topeka, to the archives there to look into things. And no, it's not really a well-known story. But the interesting thing to see, if you go down to Cherryvale, there's a very small museum there, and they have the actual weapons,
the hammer,
the
I think.
Hammer
yeah.
that they used, and also a big knife that was used. And
that survived all this.
That survived all of that.
That's
yeah.
Amazing.
So, that was just an interesting story. And I'd been aware of that for about 15 years. So when my editor called, I'm like, oh, well, there's chapter one right there.
So. Just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're visiting with author Diana Lambden Meyer about her new book, Myths and Mysteries of Kansas. She's also the author of the popular Day Trips from Kansas City Travel Guide. You know, another story in this book, which is far more poignant. And in this image of these orphan trains has just hung with me over the years, Diana. This is such a distinctly Midwestern story. We've discussed it on the show before. What were the orphan trains?
The orphan trains, I think, were one of the saddest chapters of American history.
It just gets you to this day, I think.
It really does. And I've had such a large response from around the country about this chapter. In the 1870s, 1880s, and all the immigrants were coming into New York, and there was so much disease and so many problems, there just ended up being a lot of orphans.
Yeah.
Some parents were just bad parents and neglected their children. Other times the parents died. The children were left to fend for themselves on the streets of New York. And we didn't have any child welfare services at that time. So the Children's Aid Society was formed, and they rounded up the kids. And they did the best they could at the time, trying to track down if there were any parents. Sometimes, you know, the mother had died, and it was the father who had 6, 7, 8 kids to take care of and try to work. So he would willingly give his kids to the Children's Aid Society just for better care.
And then at least one case, one of the dads was so overwhelmed by the task in front of him, I think his wife had died, he killed himself, leaving 4 kids on their own.
Yeah, little kids. I mean, infants and you know, up to teenagers. And so the Children's Aid Society basically rounded up all of the kids, took care of them, and you know, fed them, got them healthy and everything, and then organized a remarkable organization skills at that time, a number of different trains and escorts, and they would take train loads of children, and they started really stopping in Pennsylvania farm country. the greatest impact was in the plain states and the farms area. But they did stop in Pennsylvania and Michigan and some of the farm country there, but sent train loads of children, 20,000 over so many years' time, and just sent them to little towns. And there would be an ad in the newspaper announcing, gee, the orphan train is coming today. Come pick up your child, you know.
And just that's the moment that grabs you so much. These trains is pulling into these small towns, Diana. The children being paraded out onto a platform, many of them saying later they felt like they were being offered up as slaves in a sense.
Exactly.
And the townsfolks coming and saying, well, I'll take that one. I'll take this one. And that's just how it worked.
That's exactly how it worked. And, you know, they did the best they could, but many of the people in the rural agriculture areas needed hardworking boys and girls, you know, to help, you know, and they just really needed free labor. Some of the families were good and decent families.
I was going to say, as you might expect, some families, some situations worked out great, and others, of course,
just didn't. And it was, I at first, well, I picked up on little aspects of this story in different parts of my travel. And I was up in Beatrice, Nebraska, the first time that I really saw a museum exhibit on this and began understanding it. But the reason I chose the topic of the orphan train for this book is because in Concordia, Kansas, there is the National Orphan Train Museum.
I didn't know that was the case.
Just been opened about, I want to say, 2 or 3 years.
Well, I was puzzled by that. Why Concordia, Kansas, which is in north central Kansas, I believe, why is it in Concordia when the orphan train didn't stop in Concordia?
Right. It didn't. Well, it turned out there was a good depot there. There was a good force of volunteers. There wasn't a home yet for the orphan train story. And so the community leaders got together and made that happen there. And it is just, even there's a little bronze sculpture sitting out front of the old train depot. And it's just this little girl there sitting with, you know, in her little pinafore outfit and in her little boots that they wore back in those days, and holding a little suitcase with the saddest look on her face. And it just broke my heart.
Yeah, in some cases, you know, brothers would be standing together just determined to stay together and not be separated in this process. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they could work it out that way. And obviously, in many other cases, it didn't work out that way.
And if I may, can I read a paragraph or so from this chapter? For some children, their train trip west was the answer to their prayers and to the prayers of so many others. For some children, unfortunately, the dream of a happy family waiting at the end of the line turned into a nightmare. In many cases, youngsters were placed with or adopted into loving families, and then, of course, other times not. Many times, the farm families simply needed more children to work the land and help with the household chores. The children were considered an investment, like horses or mules or worse, free labor, like slaves. Of these children who came to Kansas, a little girl named Alice would eventually become a child psychologist to help other disenfranchised children. A little boy named John would be decorated for service in the Army Medical Corps during World War II. And another boy who called himself Kansas Charlie would be hanged for double murder by the age of 17.
Now, Kansas Charlie's story is particularly sad, you know, given how he was treated and where he wound up in life.
Right. Kansas Charlie, he had a medical condition. God bless him. He was a bedwetter.
Yeah.
And that was not well accepted in the households in which he was placed.
Or understood back in those days.
Certainly understood, right. And he was beaten frequently because of his bedwetting. And so he was moved from here to there to here to there and was never appreciated. He was separated from his brothers. He just really had families that did not understand, and certainly society didn't understand. And because of all of that, as he became an adolescent, he just became much more violent. But yes, he called himself Kansas Charlie, ended up on a train out of Kansas into Wyoming, murdered two young boys, and was hung by the age of 17. And And that's, you know, that's one of the sadder legacies of the orphan train. But there were other I had the wonderful opportunity of talking to the relatives, descendants of some orphan train. And some of them, you know, had their college educations paid for by unknown benefactors. And some of them just ended up in very wonderful, wonderful households with loving families. And others did not. So it's really a remarkable chapter of American history that, you know, that we often overlook.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about a new book, Myths and Mysteries of Kansas, with author Diana Lambden Meyer. Another sort of sad story, which I didn't know about either, was the story of the upbringing of Buffalo Bill Cody in Kansas. What happened to him, Diana? Because his early years here were simply awful.
They really were. And, you know, everyone knows Buffalo Bill Cody as the famous entertainer and the Indian scout, and Cody, Wyoming, you know, is named for him. But his family moved to Leavenworth. He had an uncle in Weston, Missouri, and they had come from Iowa because one of his brothers had been killed in an accident there, and his parents just wanted to get away from that. But they came during the 1850s and 60s, in the days of Bleeding Kansas, and his parents did not have strong opinions about the slavery issue. They were not abolitionist, but they didn't believe in slavery. They didn't have an opinion one way or the other. But you couldn't live in Kansas at that time
and without not have an opinion.
You had to have an opinion, and you had to state it publicly. And so finally his father, they didn't care what the mom thought because mom didn't get to vote. But a lot of pressure on the father. And finally, you know, he said, well, you know, I'm against slavery. I don't believe in slavery. And that was not well accepted. And so he was stabbed by a crowd. And Buffalo Bill helped his father escape from that. And so for years, his father was moved around.
He was on the run, basically.
Was basically on the run.
In his home state, yeah.
There was one story. He was at their family home in Leavenworth and was recovering from, I think he had pneumonia or something as a result of the stab wound to his lung.
And here comes the mob.
Right. Here, the mob is surrounding the house, and mom is on the front porch trying to talk him down and whatever. And little Buffalo Bill was 8 years old, I believe, at that time, and his older sister were standing at their father's bed with clubs and axes to protect their father when the crowd got to them. I'm like, that's a pretty tough thing for kids to have to do. And another time, Buffalo Bill was sick with the flu, and word came that a mob had found out where he was. So Buffalo Bill, sick with the flu, and he was the man of the house then at 8 years old. And they threw him on the back of a horse, and he had to ride like the wind to alert his father. And he was so sick or so scared or whatever that he had thrown up all over the horse, just over and over. But he got there in time, warned his father. His father escaped to another safe house. And this went on for years and years. So, not just that drama. When Dad was gone, Mom, you know, was trying to hold the family together, but the pro-slavery forces stole from the family, stole all of their crops, you know. They couldn't even eat. One time there was a keg of dynamite found under the front porch of the house. They stole all of their livestock and all of their farm equipment and everything. There was no way for the family to survive.
Well, you sort of wonder what Buffalo Bill Cody said about Kansas years later, if he grew to hate the state or if he sort of got past it somehow.
You know, I think he got past it. I think he just realized it was a time. It was just the time and the conditions, what the nation was going through. But he became one of the youngest riders on the Pony Express. And so all of these things he accomplished at very, very young ages. And the question that I ask, wow, was he really, you know, this talented, this great of an individual?
Yeah.
Or was he just a scared little boy, you know, trying to take care of his family and survive in the times? And anyway, he became a fabulous entertainer. And just a little aside, Cody, Wyoming is his namesake town, and I was just there in February. There's a fabulous new Buffalo Bill exhibit at the Historical Center there that just opened up. Everybody in this area has got to get there and see that because they represent the days of Kansas very well.
Now, what's this about Amelia Earhart having a long-lost daughter? Interesting story.
A long-lost daughter. Again, when my editor called me and said, well, you've got to do something on Amelia Earhart, and I'm like,
what hasn't been done before?
Yeah, what can I write and say about Amelia Earhart that hasn't been done?
So how did you approach that issue as an author? What did you do?
Well, and that was even my first test chapter. That was my first chapter to do as an example that I could do this entire book. And I'm like, oh, crap. Excuse my language. Can I say crap on the radio? And so just basically I started out and went to Atchison. And Louise Foudray is the caretaker of the Amelia Earhart home. And I sat down and talked to her. I said, I've got this problem. Tell me something here. What has not been said? What do you know? You know, give me some impressions.
Did it take her very long to go to the
story? Oh, she is a lovely, opinionated woman. Mm-hmm. And she has no problem talking. She's a wonderful interview. And she, first of all, very much believes it's not the she was firm to state it is not the position of the 99s, the organization that owns the house and employs her. It is her personal opinion that Amelia Earhart faked her own death.
Really?
And yes. And that she came back and visited the house.
And others think that's the case as well.
Yes. But Louise Foudray, told me several stories that could have been the long-lost daughter that a lot of people talk about, or could have been Amelia Earhart herself coming to that house to look around.
I mean, what do you think? Isn't the evidence fairly strong that Earhart disappeared out there because the plane hit the drink?
That's my opinion, but mm-hmm. Who am I? I haven't been anywhere to investigate it. But
so the evidence for this notion there may have been a long-lost daughter, you tell a very compelling story about what happens there one day when there's a group going through the home and there's a couple of women in the back of the pack who are looking around, clearly knowing things about the house.
Right.
They
were people who were very, very sure of where they were going, familiar with the rooms and everything. And they were not staying with the tour group, you know. You're supposed to stay in the group. And Louise,
they were wandering off.
They were wandering off. And so Louise was yelling at them and getting them back in the group. But it was very obvious that they knew the house and they were looking for something. But at that time, there was some renovation going on under the house, around the house. And so one of the hallways was blocked off. And what was blocked off in that hallway was a beautiful dining room and a kind of a kitchen nook area, really, that had a beautiful stained glass window. And that certainly would have been something you would have remembered very well from your childhood or, you know, if you were a young girl and had visited the house. And so this young woman or this elderly woman became very upset. She couldn't find what she was looking for. She was looking for these windows, and she became very upset. And the men with her said, "You're getting too upset. We should go now. We should go." And Louise Foudray watched them as they left the house and got into, this black Cadillac, limousine. I'm sorry, it was a limousine, and drove away. And Louise just swears up and down, that was someone, either Amelia Earhart or the long-lost daughter who'd come back to this house.
And that's why you call this book Myths and Mysteries of Kansas, because it's a heck of a mystery.
Right.
Well, your own aunt is included in this book, and she is Amanda Lambden Douthat.
Douthat, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you talk about a fortune maybe buried on the family farm.
Right. Yeah. And, somehow my end of the family didn't end up with that fortune. I want to make that very clear.
That's why you wrote the book, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm making a fortune off the book.
Yeah.
But my family first settled in the 1860s around Paoli, Indiana. And if anyone knows the history of Independence, Kansas, it was settled by a wagon train from Paoli, Indiana. And so my descendants or my family was not from that first wagon train, but it was about 3 years later that they swapped the land sight unseen with a family out there. A family wanted to come back to Paoli. Anyway, so my family takes off and they're in the wagon train and they end up in Kansas and down by Independence. And the farm is where the airport is now in Independence, Kansas, and it's just a few miles from the Laurie Ingalls Wilder homestead. Mm. And so, you know, we were close by. We were neighbors, I guess. But long story, my Aunt Amanda was married twice. Her first husband died when a mule kicked him in the head.
Ah.
Ouch, yes. But he was working for the railroad. And at that time, the railroad provided life insurance, which, again, how common was that? I wouldn't have thought life insurance was something anybody had in the 1880s. And it was a little bit later than that. But anyway, Aunt Amanda, being a good farm girl, took her $3,000 and invested it in land. And this is the farm. That land, eventually they discovered oil on that mm-hmm. land.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Aunt Amanda's a wealthy woman. And then there's the stock market crash. There's the Great Depression of 1929. She lost everything. But then, my goodness, they build a railroad through town. And sure enough, here the railroad comes right through where Aunt Amanda's farm is. So
Aunt Amanda's had an interesting life here.
I would love to have met that woman. Anyway, and she marries again, and that husband dies. So in the 1950s, she is 88 years old, a little old woman living out in the country by herself. But there's still oil, lease, you know, the money coming in from the oil and mineral rights there. There's still money coming in from the railroad, and she's renting out some of her farmland. She's got a ton of money coming in, and so what does she do with it? Most people wouldn't have thought a penny thought about that, but apparently somebody was watching and realized her lifestyle. She didn't put it in the banks. She didn't trust the banks, like a lot of people didn't after the Great Depression. So she started putting it in tin cans and pickle jars and burying it around the farm. And apparently, after my granddad was in there, and he told so many stories that when they were taking the dishes out of the house, you know, here's the plates stacked up mm-hmm. and $20 bills lined between the stacks of plates.
Funny.
In the coffee cups and things in the back of the cabinets, there's wads of $20 bills. My granddad was a very, very tall man, and he went into the chicken coop and just kind of, you know, his head was hitting the rafter, and there was a baking soda tin there loaded with $20 bills.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
Basically, this was my Aunt Amanda's bank. And so the mystery there is that someone broke in on her, beat on her for about 3 days, and ransacked the house looking for money. And apparently they found a lot. I mean, there, you know, you could tell that, you know, all the outbuildings had been ransacked. The couches had been ripped open, all the books out of the bookshelf, you know, that kind of thing. And then finally the mail carrier, and we talk about the post office closing now and their role of checking on people now and then. I think about this. The mail carrier realized that Aunt Amanda hadn't been picking up her mail. And so he came up the dirt lane to her house, and he was the one to find her. She lived. She lived for a few months, was in a long-term care facility, and eventually died of her injuries.
Quite a story.
Are we talking too long?
No, lots of interesting stories and myths and mysteries of Kansas. Diana, we're out of time, but thank you for your time coming in today. It was so good to have you again.
Thank you.
That's Diana Lambda Meyer. She's also author of Day Trips from Kansas City. That guide and a new edition is just out.